Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. This is episode 2. I am your host, David Yosifan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. This is the second of an initial run of 10 episodes exploring the proper role of corporations in our society. In the first episode, I gave an overview of my own thinking, criticizing the shareholder primacy norm in corporate governance and suggesting some reformative approaches that I think might make corporations more responsive to a wider set of stakeholders other than just shareholders. Today, we're going to hear from one of the masters of the dominant account, and you're going to hear him make the case for it as well as I think anybody could possibly make it. We also have a thoughtful exchange regarding some of my criticisms of that approach of shareholder primacy in what I hope you will find is an engaging and useful conversation. Please subscribe to us on iTunes to make sure that you're getting each episode as they are updated. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifan. That's at David Yosifon on Twitter. We will make note of all new episodes as they are posted. This episode is sponsored by the Markola Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University. We are short on bells and whistles, but we are big on ideas, so cue your own private introduction music, and here we go. Episode 2. My guest today is Professor Stephen Bainbridge, the William D. Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. Professor Bainbridge is an accomplished and prolific scholar. He's written more than 75
law review articles,
placed them in the most prestigious journals, the Harvard Law Review, the Virginia Law Review, the Stanford Law Review, you name it, his work has appeared there. He's also the author of numerous books on corporate law, including The New Corporate Governance in Theory and Practice, which he published in 2008, and his most recent book, Corporate Governance After the Financial Crisis, which he published in 2012 and which is going to serve as the point of departure for our conversation today. Professor Bainbridge has been repeatedly named by the National Association of Corporate Directors as one of the 100 most influential people in the field of corporate governance. I don't know if that list gets more nuanced than the 100 most influential people, but I'm sure if they did specify more precisely, Professor Bainbridge would rank pretty high within the 100. I want to say that when one is starting out in an academic life or an intellectual journey, I think that you learn best from people with whom you generally agree, people that share your outlook. But as you mature as an intellectual, as a scholar, this approach begins to have diminishing returns, and ultimately it can be positively corrosive to one's development. When you reach a certain level of maturity, the way to really learn is to study people that you disagree with. I often disagree with Stephen Bainbridge, but I've learned a great deal from him. I understand my own ideas a lot better because of him, and I'm really honored to have him on the podcast. So thanks very much, Professor Bainbridge, for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
So in your book, The Corporate Governance After the Financial Crisis, you review federal responses to the Enron-type accounting scandals of the early 2000s that resulted in the Sarbanes-Oxley mm-hmm. reforms and federal responses to the subprime crisis and the global credit crisis of 2008 that resulted in the Dodd-Frank reforms. Both mm-hmm. of these sets of reforms you criticize, but both sets of reforms were aimed at strengthening shareholder primacy in firm governance. What I mean by that when I use the term is that both of these reforms were focused or had the intention of trying to get corporations to operate more effectively in the shareholder interest. Now, I know you think those reforms did so poorly, but why do you suppose that neither of these reform movements deviated from a focus on shareholder primacy?
Well, That's a very good question. One of the things that you have to understand about my approach to both Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank was that it was very informed by the work that was done by my colleague here at UCLA, Stuart Banner, on how the law responds to financial crises. And one of the things that Banner did in his book on the history of securities regulation is basically to show that after every major financial crisis, and he traces this all the way back in American history and then into English history as far back as the Bubble Act of 16, whatever it was, in response to the South Sea bubble. Banner shows that consistently the law has done two things. First, it has fought the last war. In other words, it's made reforms that were designed to prevent the type of financial crisis that we had just gone through without necessarily considering whether that would solve future problems and without really considering whether it would impede doing business during more normal financial times. And this is a fairly consistent pattern that other scholars have picked up on, such as Roberta Romano and Larry Ribstein. And one of the things that Romano had done in a wonderful article that she called Quack Corporate Governance about Sarbanes-Oxley was to show that the provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley were not really, for the most part, new, but rather were ideas that had been floating around for a long time that were advocated by certain policy entrepreneurs. And for the most part, these were ideas that were heavily influenced by institutional investors. We had consistently, if you sort of go through both Sarbanes-Oxley and in particular Dodd-Frank, you get a laundry list of provisions that were basically, long-standing policy goals of the institutional investor community. And therefore, the statute sort of reflected their policy preferences. We get a situation after a financial crisis where Congress says, oh my God, something has to be done. The electorate is all upset. We have to restore investor confidence. We have to keep our jobs by making the voters happy. And so as Congress is sort of looking around for something to do, these policy entrepreneurs come in with sort of prepackaged ideas that Congress can adopt off the shelf, and that's why you tend to get repeatedly the phenomenon where Congress will move in the direction of the institutional investor, particularly the big union pension funds, the big state and local government pension funds, moving their agenda forward.
Because these institutional investor policy entrepreneurs do some of their most influential elements are public labor unions. Do you think that these reforms will provide or do provide a kind of backdoor route towards a departure from shareholder primacy in that it gives institutional investors through greater access to the proxy, greater say on pay, et cetera, it gives institutional investors in the form of labor unions greater influence in corporate governance that is at least nominally focused on shareholder primacy, but will in fact be oriented towards other stakeholders who are wearing the cloak of shareholders, if you will?
That's a very interesting question, and I think it is certainly the case that there have been times when union pension funds have used their corporate governance influence and their ability to do things like run proxy contests to oppose directors who are up for election and so forth. There have been times where the unions have used their power as shareholders to advance goals that they have as labor unions rather than as investors. You know, the sort of classic example that we're very familiar with out here in California was when we had that big grocery strike back about 10 years ago now, and the head of the union that represented the grocery store employees was also at that time the president of the board of trustees of CalPERS, and was using CalPERS, the big California public employee retention retirement system pension fund, was using that their power as a shareholder to try to influence the election of the directors of grocery stores like Safeway, basically as a way of trying to get those directors to concede to the union's collective bargaining demands. On the other hand, I think there is a genuine recognition, to give credit where credit's due, among the union pension funds that, you know, they are investor fiduciaries. You know, they are genuinely, if I think sometimes misguidedly, trying to use corporate governance in a way that advances both their socio-political agendas on issues like compensation and income inequality, while at the same time trying to maximize the return that they get for their investors. And so it's not a something where you can say they always pursue, you know, socio-political goals at the expense of investment goals, or vice versa. It tends to be more on a case-by-case basis.
And do you think that is, in your study of the dynamic, do you think that is a political decision, or is it an intellectual, conceptual one? That is, do you think that the labor movement has conceded that there is just not the political vocabulary in the United States to more substantially reform corporate governance norms to give labor directly a place at the table, to give consumers or other stakeholders directly a place at the table? And so they, conceding that, they operate as best they can within shareholder primacy? Or do you think there has been a genuine embrace of the legitimacy and overall social utility of shareholder primacy and firm governance by the labor movement?
Yeah, that's an interesting question again. And I think that the labor movement is in conflict within itself on those issues. Certainly, there are people in the labor movement who see basically stock ownership through pension funds as a vehicle for advancing a set of socio-political goals that they are no longer able to do, particularly because of the diminishing importance of private sector unions, you know, with only, what, about 6% of the American workforce now represented by private sector unions. They're using their position as shareholders, where they own a very considerable amount of American corporate stock, to achieve their socio-political goals. At the same time, you also have people in the movement who are very aware that they are investor fiduciaries and are trying to do what we might call value-oriented investing. That is to say, they are trying to accomplish maximizing shareholder returns to their pensioners, within the context of also trying to do social good as they see it.
Now, in your book, Corporate Governance After the Financial Crisis, you argue that you concede to some extent that corporate governance failures may have been responsible for the Enron-type accounting scandals that we saw in the early 2000s, even if you're not satisfied with the federal response to those problems in Sarbanes-Oxley. But you assert that corporate governance as such was not responsible for the subprime mortgage meltdown. So I want to ask you, do you have a view about what was then responsible? And even if corporate governance was not did not cause the meltdown, might a different set of governance norms in corporate governance law have nevertheless prevented the crisis or stemmed the crisis from becoming as bad as it did?
Yeah, I think the evidence does seem to suggest that bad corporate governance was not associated with the subprime mortgage crisis, with one exception that we can come back to. But if you look at the studies that were done of the major banks that were involved in the subprime mortgage crisis, for the most part, those studies that I recited some length in the book tend to show that there's no real correlation between indicia of bad corporate governance and the likelihood that you were going to get into trouble by having either committed errors in judgment with respect to subprime lending and the securitization of such loans or outright fraud in connection with that. Now, the one exception, and it's a pervasive exception, was the failure of firms to engage in effective enterprise-wide risk management. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how firms prior to the financial crisis tended not to have effective enterprise-wide risk management designed to determine whether or not the firm was adequately hedging its risks, whether it was taking excessive risks, whether it even understood the risks that it was taking. And so that was an area that definitely needed improvement. One of the curious things, though, and the disconnect that I try to emphasize in the book is, even if you assume that corporate governance was a contributor to the subprime mortgage crisis, the logic of Dodd-Frank and its response is puzzling. For example, I think there's general agreement, as I noted, that enterprise risk management was a major failing and a pervasive failing prior to the crisis. And yet Dodd-Frank does very little to encourage more effective risk management. Rather, what you have in Dodd-Frank in terms of corporate governance is, as you noted, a whole array of shareholder empowerment functions. And so, for example, we have shareholder say on pay. Now, let's think about the logic of that for a minute. If you believe the corporate governance failure story, then what you believe is that executives took excessive risk. Why did they take excessive risk? Because their compensation scheme is skewed towards rewarding them for short-term stock performance, because the bulk of their compensation comes in the form of stock options and other short-term stock price-related bonus schemes and so forth. Therefore, the argument goes, management had incentive to take excessive levels of risk, particularly short-term risk, that ultimately caught up with them. Now, the irony of this, of course, is that those sort of performance-based pay schemes were adopted precisely because the argument was that we should align management interest with the stockholder interest, and we should have managers get paid based on whether or not the stockholders are getting a high return on their investment. So our solution to this problem of managers were under pressure on their compensation to maximize short-term stock prices, our response to that in Dodd-Frank was to say, okay, let's give the shareholders even more power to pressure management via compensation to maximize shareholder returns. I mean, if you believe the corporate governance story, the response is simply going to make things worse.
Well, right? That's analysis that you just laid out seems to me to make a very compelling case for a response to the crisis or a set of reforms that endeavor to get corporate directors, to get the board of directors to be not so focused on shareholder interests exclusively, but rather to take a broader perspective, because it was the very alignment of directorial incentives with the shareholder incentive that was the cause of the crisis to begin with. But I'm surprised to be here. I'm surprised to hear you making that case.
Well, the question, though, is what is the policy consequence from that? One policy consequence from that is to say, okay, we're going to take a corporate social responsibility approach, which is basically to say we're going to encourage directors to consider social interests, not just shareholder interests. The alternative, and the one that I favor, is basically to say, look, directors ought to manage the corporation in the long-term sustainable interest of the shareholders. And that the problem that we have today in corporate governance is an excessive focus on short-termism brought on by hedge funds, by pension funds, all of which are very focused on, you know, short-term returns to shareholders. And my argument would be there's nothing wrong with corporations being designed to maximize shareholder wealth. It's the pressure of short-termism that what we really need to do is to insulate boards of directors from pressure to maximize short-term shareholder gains so that directors are freer to consider how to maximize in a sustainable way long-term shareholder wealth. And that, I think, is obviously not a corporate social responsibility model, but on the other hand, I think that if you emphasize long-term sustainable growth of shareholder wealth, that's not necessarily inconsistent with the idea that shareholders and stakeholders will both benefit. Long-term sustainable corporate growth seems to me to be likely to be in the benefit of key corporate stakeholders just as much as it is in the interest of shareholders.
Well, let me ask you further about that substantive commitment to the long term, because it's something I'm often perplexed about, and I think is perhaps under-theorized, at least in colloquial conversations about corporate activity. Why is, I mean, I'm brought to mind of Keynes's famous line that in the long run we're all dead. So why is it, what drives your now substantive commitment to the long-term sustainability or long-term profitability of corporations rather than the short-term? After all, people are dying of starvation all around the world right now. So perhaps we need to maximize utility presently or maximize, you know, retirement benefits or capital growth presently rather than in the long term. So can you say a bit more about why you think this focus on the long term is substantively more desirable than the short term?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. And first off, I do think we have to remember that what we are talking about here is corporate governance, mm-hmm. as opposed to the wide array of public policies that address issues like income inequality and poverty, and so on. And I would encourage your listeners to track down a wonderful article by our corporate law colleague, Gordon Smith, who teaches at BYU, called The Dystopian Potential of Corporate Law. And it's available at www.ssrn.com if you search for Gordon Smith in their search function. And Smith does, I think, a wonderful job of sort of explaining why it is that we really can't expect corporate law changes to make the world a better place. It's just corporate. It's not what corporate law does, mm-hmm. right? What corporate law does is to sort out, in very general terms, the relationship between directors and shareholders, and to a lesser extent, the relationship between directors and managers and creditors. But it's primarily a story about the relationship between board of directors, the management, and the shareholders. And really doesn't have the tools to address, you know, large-scale social problems. And that corporate law is better off basically focusing on what it does well, which is to deal with the question of what are the fiduciary duties and the other obligations of directors to shareholders. And if you want to have corporations address, you know, the variety of social ills that exist, you know, I think it's more effectively done through things like general welfare legislation. It's more effectively done through, you know, the sort of public policy incentives that President Obama's using. I think, for example, this new program that's been announced where companies have agreed to not discriminate against the long-term unemployed is a good example of the sort of thing I'm talking about, where, you know, it's not saying to the board of directors, look, you have a fiduciary duty to society to hire the long-term unemployed so as to address the social problem of persistent unemployment, and so as to address the problem of, you know, an emergent permanent underclass of the unemployed, but rather to say to directors, look, your job is to maximize shareholder wealth within the limits of the law and ethical obligations that you're subject to, within that to then say to them, okay, and while you're maximizing shareholder wealth, we want you to do it subject to certain ethical constraints, one of which is going to be perhaps this hiring the long-term unemployed. And, you know, going back to the question of long-term sustainable growth, I think this is a good example. If you wanted to maximize short-term profits, you probably don't want to hire people who have been out of work for 6 months. They may not be ready to step back into full-time employment. You know, there may be reasons why they haven't been able to find full-time employment. But on the other hand, you know, if you take a long-term perspective in terms of bringing people back into employment, expanding the economy, expanding your market, it might well have long-term benefits. And so that's why I think, you know, you want to have directors focused on long-term sustainable growth, and to the extent that we want corporations to address, you know, these sort of social problems, I think you do it outside the context of the corporate law casebook.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question along that line of argument. You pointed to a specific proposal coming out of the Obama administration in terms of general welfare legislation. But from a conceptual standpoint, I want to put this question to you. You've made the case just now, and you do so quite eloquently in this book and in your Corporate Governance in Theory and Practice book, that one of the reasons that we can rely on shareholder, that we can allow, that we can rely, that we can encourage shareholder exclusivity in corporate governance is because broader social interests are better attended to in the domain, as you say, of general welfare legislation. But what I want to ask you is whether that is a plausible framework, given that corporations, once they are charged with maximizing shareholder value, then have an incentive to also operate within the political domain to pursue shareholder profits where they might be had in the political domain. And one of the ways, for example, that they might be pursued is by stunting the development of general welfare legislation that might reduce profits, such as environmental regulations or worker protection statutes or consumer protection statutes. And this problem of the presence of the shareholder primacy firm in the political arena has been exacerbated by the Citizens United opinion, which gives corporations the constitutional right to be present in that domain. So I have tried to argue in some of my work that so long as Citizens United is good constitutional law, shareholder primacy is bad corporate theory.
Yeah, well, the sort of raw political answer to that is that general welfare legislation may or may not be a good idea. And essentially, you have to determine that in the marketplace of ideas. And the marketplace of ideas is a market, because as we know, to communicate effectively with voters and their elected officials, you have to be able to speak. You have to have a soapbox. I have a soapbox on my blog at ProfessorBainbridge.com that costs me a certain amount of money every month to run. You know, speech is not free in that sense. And so if you're going to have, for example, unions and nonprofits and the like advocating in the marketplace of ideas, why do you want to systematically exclude business from that? Secondly, as you know, the issue of corporate personhood is much broader than the narrow question that was presented in Citizens United, and I'm sure you've seen these proposed constitutional amendments that would essentially eliminate the whole concept of corporate personhood under the Constitution as a response to Citizens United. But I hope you know your listeners are going to think about what follows from that if the New York Times is a corporation. If we say corporations don't have First Amendment rights, what do we do about cases like New York Times versus Sullivan, which held that the New York Times, as a newspaper, had certain First Amendment protections against defamation and libel laws? If we're going to say that corporations aren't persons with constitutional rights, does that mean that the government can search corporate property without having to have a warrant? If we're going to say corporations aren't persons, how would corporations own property? How would they be sued, and how would they sue in their own name if they're not a legally cognizable person? And so the argument against Citizens United has to be essentially one of, we just don't like what corporations say. And okay, you know, that's fair enough. I don't like what unions say, but I'm not trying to defund unions. So, you know, I think that essentially what the whole debate over Citizens United has become is essentially trying to defund your opposition, right? And, you know, that's, I suppose, fair game in the political arena. But it seems to me that we've folks are trying to accomplish that in ways that are rather naive and fail to take into account the fact that corporate personhood is an essential attribute of having a functioning economy with large-scale businesses. And so, let's just be honest. What we don't like about Citizens United is not the fact that we treat the corporation as a legal person. Some of folks just don't like Citizens United because they don't like the fact that corporations tend to spend more on Republicans than Democrats, although, of course, proportionately, corporations tend to be much more even-handed politically than say unions or nonprofits are.
Well, I would tend to agree with you with respect to the importance of maintaining the concept of corporate personhood, and even agree with you that Citizens United, as a constitutional matter, as it relates to principles of free association and free speech, was rightly decided. But given that it's rightly decided, I'm not so sure that the case for shareholder primacy and firm governance is as strong as it was before Citizens United, given that the riposte that we always get to the excesses, the overreaching, the exploitative orientation, the externalizing orientation of the profit maximizing corporation is always appeal to general welfare legislation. I'm not sure that riposte is as plausible, given the fact that when you go to the political bodies, you're going to confront that same externalizing corporation.
All right, but let me give you a hypothetical. Let's play law school for a second. Let's say that we change the fiduciary duties of corporate directors, and we say to corporate directors, when you make corporate decisions, you should consider the impact of your decision, not just on shareholders, but also on stakeholders such as employees, consumers, customers, the communities in which you do business, and the society at large. In effect, we would take what the so-called non-shareholder constituency statutes that a lot of states have adopted and say, that's really the fiduciary duties of directors. Okay, and then the directors are sitting there and someone comes to them and says, I want to buy your company. And I want you to drop your poison pill, your other takeover defenses, and allow me to go forward and make an offer to your shareholders. Mm-hmm. And the board of directors is sitting there saying, okay, well, what's going to happen to us if this guy buys the company? Answer, we're all going to lose our jobs. We're going to be canned. And so the board of directors says, well, you know, buddy, we've considered the interests of our constituents and our shareholders. And yes, the shareholders would get a big pile of money from you, but boy, you know, you'd close factories, you'd hurt the employees, you'd hurt the communities, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to say no. Mm-hmm. Now suppose the board of directors gets a pitch that says, you know, look, I'm going to buy your company. We'll pay the shareholders. But I'm going to keep all you guys on. I'm going to give you, you know, I'm going to make you members of the combined company board. I'm going to give you consulting contracts. You know, the sort of classic problem that you get in mergers where the target board of directors are given essentially side payments to approve the deal. Mm-hmm. And now the target board says, well, you know, we've considered the interests of all of our constituents, and we're really sorry about all the employees that will lose their job when the factories are closed, but it's such a good deal for our shareholders and our creditors that, well, we're going to take it. Mm-hmm. The problem with saying that directors can think about all interests that might be relevant is that it essentially creates a situation in which directors are always going to be able to find some interest, some constituency interest, that's identical to their interests. Mm-hmm. And human nature will incline the directors to, in some cases, take that. And granted, in most situations, the business judgment rule doesn't let you judicially review what the board of directors has done. But there are, of course, cases, Revlon cases, where judicial review is available. And even if judicial review is not available, it at least has some sort of aspirational effect. So I just am concerned. I mean, the bottom line I have with corporate social responsibility is that directors who are responsible to everyone are responsible to no one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a profound challenge to those that would pursue a multi-stakeholder form of governance. But I want to ask you to what extent that problem really differs in kind from the problem that directors presently face. After all, the self-interested motivation is certainly present in the corporate takeover context today. And as you say, the business judgment rule, or the slightly stronger enhanced business judgment rule, certainly gives directors plenty of cover under the prevailing regime to pursue their own interests at the expense of shareholders. But really, beyond that, I want to ask you about about presently conflicting obligations that directors have, that we acknowledge that they have a responsibility to reconcile in good faith, and that is the competing interests, for example, of shareholders who are taking a long-term perspective versus those who are taking a short-term perspective. The competing interests of shareholders who are highly diversified, who might prefer a more risk-preferring form of corporate governance, versus shareholders who have a concentrated investment and would prefer a more risk-averse corporate governance strategy. We already put these irreconcilable tensions in the boardroom and resolve to allow the directors to balance them in a good faith, deliberative fashion and defer to their judgment so long as they're disinterested. So how different in kind really is the balancing act with respect to multi-stakeholder interests as compared to different kinds of shareholder interests?
Well, I think that's a very legitimate question, and it's a very important question. To paraphrase the biblical aphorism, the poor you will always have with you, agency costs we will always have with us. You cannot avoid the problem of conflicted interests whenever you have people managing other people's money. As long as the corporations are big enough that it's not meaningfully possible for their shareholders to use consensus and some sort of democratic decision-making, that we have to delegate authority to a smaller group such as the board of directors, you're always going to have those sort of conflicts of interest. The question is prudentially, can we cabin those sort of conflicts of interest so as to minimize them to the extent possible at the lowest possible cost? Obviously, we don't want to spend $2 on precautions to prevent a dollar's worth of agency costs. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I think the question comes down to one of how exacerbated would we make the problem of agency costs if we introduce a metric that includes not just profit to the shareholders, but also other constituency interests. And as you correctly point out, directors already face conflicts between shareholders who have short-term interests, long-term interests, shareholders who are, values investors versus shareholders who, only care about, profit maximization, and so on. But when you introduce, presumably all shareholders share at least a common interest in the corporation making money over some time horizon in a way that's maximally returned to the shareholders. When you introduce competing metrics, right, and you say to the board, we aren't just going to measure you by how much money you're earning for the shareholders, but we're also going to measure you by a whole variety of social metrics. I think that introduces a complexity in the monitoring problem that that does make that different in kind and not just in degree, simply because now we don't just have agreement over the time horizon for the appropriate metric. We don't even now have agreement on what the appropriate metrics are. And so, I take your point. It's certainly a very valid point. But at the end of the day, we're making sort of prudential judgments about whether or not this is an effective way of achieving whatever your goals are. And I, as I say, I'm simply not convinced that corporate law is the place to deal with social problems. And I take your Citizens United point. But part of that is, of course, fundamental disagreement about how you address social ills. And so, as long as society doesn't agree about how to solve things like income inequality, I'm not sure that the changing corporate law fiduciary duties is going to get you anywhere.
Well, that's a very powerful set of reflections, and I think we're going to spend some time in this podcast series taking them up again and again, and reviewing what further challenges we might make to them, or ultimately perhaps deciding to embrace the perspective that articulates them. So I'm really grateful for your time, Professor Bainbridge. I want to ask you one further question if you have the time for it.
Sure.
And this is departing from the substance of our corporate law conversation. Professor Bainbridge is one of the most productive scholars, I think, operating in certainly in the legal academy today. His blog alone, which you I should have mentioned earlier, ProfessorBainbridge.com, provides nearly every day tremendous ideas, reflections, often humorous, often intellectually challenging. But the law review articles also keep coming, the books keep coming, the casebooks keep coming. So one of the things this podcast is interested in is the production of knowledge. And some people, I think, can't read quite as fast as you seem to be able to write. And so I wanted to ask you if you would just share some of your own, how is it that you're able to be so productive, and what advice would you have for scholars or students or activists, people that are in the knowledge production game, perhaps focused on corporate governance issues, to be more productive in their own work?
Well, That's a very good question, and the joking answer is, I don't have kids and I don't have a social life, and so I have lots of time on my hands. The more serious answer is that productivity is largely a function of two things. It's a function of developing a base of knowledge in an area that allows you to work on a whole bunch of different projects, all of which are grounded in the same base of knowledge, so that you're not reinventing the intellectual wheel every time. I have colleagues who, you know, basically they write an article about agency, and then an article about partnership, and then an article about corporations, and then an article about taxes. And, you know, if you look at my work, I've done, you know, work in different areas, but for the last 10 or 15 years, I've been writing about what I call director primacy, and, you know, director primacy in takeovers, director primacy in proxy contests, director primacy in this, director primacy in that, to the point where a dear friend of mine called me up and said, the world does not need another article by Stephen Bainbridge with director primacy in the title. But that series of articles was much easier, because basically I had established a model and a body of research that I could then spin multiple projects off of. The second thing is, you know, quite frankly, why get one resume line if you can get three, right? The two books that we were talking about today that were published by the Oxford Press Books were basically books that I sat down and I took what I had been writing about in the law reviews and rewrote and repackaged and revised and updated. But basically, it was taking the ideas that I'd been developing over the previous 4 or 5 years and working them up to make a coherent argument across, you know, a broad number of topics. And so, you know, it's not just that I repackaged the law review articles, but basically I was able to get multiple iterations of director primacy in takeovers and director primacy in proxy contests and so forth, and get it in the law review articles and then rework it, rethink it, revise it, and then have it appear in a book form. And so, you know, and very often I'll borrow from the books when I'm doing blog posts. And so, you know, if I'm not getting 3 or 4 projects out of any given body of research, then I'm not maximizing my return on my investment in doing that research.
I think this is what Dylan perhaps had in mind when he said, I'll know my song well before I start singing. You know your song well, and then you can jump onto any stage or sit down with any group. And who doesn't want to hear another version of Dylan singing Hard Rain? And who doesn't want to read another version of Stephen Bainbridge reflecting on director primacy?
Well, you'll have a chance, because I'm doing one. I got invited to go down to New Zealand and do a lecture down there. So I'm doing director primacy in New Zealand company.
We'll look forward to that. And we're very, very grateful for this conversation. I have no doubt it's been edifying to our listeners, certainly been edifying to me. And I hope that as your work continues to come out, we can have another conversation some short time down the road.
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Professor Bainbridge. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, that's it. That's our interview with Professor Stephen Bainbridge of UCLA Law School. Very challenging set of ideas. As I said at the beginning, you've got to expose yourself to the best. You've got to take their ideas seriously if you want to test the mettle of your own. We will continue to take up the legitimacy of shareholder primacy and corporate governance in the rest of this podcast series, as well as turning to other issues relating to corporate social responsibility in subsequent episodes. So please subscribe to us on iTunes, Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's at David YOSIFON on Twitter. Thanks again to the Markola Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University for sponsoring this episode. cue your own exit music, little jazz, little piano flourish, some punk rock, get it set in your mind, let it roll. We'll talk to you next week.